Greetings and welcome to the 39th edition of Dinosaur Science in the Bible with Dr. John Nay. And Dr. John, we're continuing to our discussion that we had last week on the fossil record, are we not?
Yes, we are. And do I have a bone to pick with some evolutionists relative to this topic? Absolutely. Something you can really sink your teeth into. Well, you know, as a scripture that I've alluded to many times on many programs, Dave, is Proverbs 18, verse 17, which says, "Any story sounds true until someone tells the other side." And when it comes to the fossil record, that is so true. You know, we have these fossils, billions upon billions of fossils on a global scale. By the way, a vivid testament to the factuality of a global flood. But we have all these fossils here. And a paleontologist, if you will, a guy that digs up bones, he'll dig up a bone and he'll look at this physical object, this bone, and give a story about this bone. You know, what it was a part of, what it might have looked like. Even with the sophisticated means now, what the diet was of this creature or this human, if you will. And we have a story surrounding this physical object. Well, the story that absolutely permeates our culture relative to the fossil record is that it is absolute impeccable evidence of the factuality of evolution. And is there another story relative to these bones? And the answer most certainly is yes. You can take and look through your personal paradigm of the Bible, talking about a Christian transformed by the renewing of his mind through filling his mind with God's Word, and see the same bone and have a completely different story relative to that bone. Now, the challenge comes when you have two stories relative to a physical object, and those two stories are in diametric opposition to one another. Not only that, but they're non-synchristic and non-consonant. Besides that, they don't go together either. Okay, either one story is true, the other story is false, or they both are false, and somewhere there's a story that is true. Now, when it comes again to the fossil record, that is presented as an icon, a pillar, giving evidence to the factuality of evolution. And, of course, there is another story. Last week, remember, Dave, I showed you this little drawing here of what appears to be an eight, two circles, one upon another. And you know, I ask you what you thought might be missing.
You're not going to trick me again this time, are you?
No, I got you really apprehensive, don't I?
You do.
Well, you don't trick easily. But anyway, I got you last week unawares. But what I showed Dave again last week was what appears to be an eight, and that's the only story he had relative to what he was seeing. He saw these two circles, one upon another, and my question really was misleading in that I asked him, what do you think is missing? What do you think is missing from what you see? Now, my question implied that there was something missing, number one. Okay, number two, it implied that there had been something else there, because if there hadn't been something else there, it couldn't have been missing, okay? And when we talk about missing links, to use the term missing links, which is a term used, of course, relative to the fossil record, that we're assuming, number one, that there's something missing, and number two, that there had been something there initially so that it now could be missing. And we are also assuming, relative to the fossil record, that the evolution process evolving from one kind to another kind is true. Because you see, for the creationist that believes in the Genesis chapter 1 account, 10 times we're told in Genesis chapter 1 that things reproduce according to their various kinds. In other words, dogs have puppies and cats have kittens, etc. Okay, so for the creationist is not looking for a missing link, because according to the creation account, that link was never there between, let's say, reptile and bird to be missing now. So that's kind of where we picked up last week, I was conscience stricken, Dave, as I would lie in bed late that night thinking of tricking you with that question. Oh, I know. I repent, okay? But I'll do it again if I get a chance. So anyway, this fossil record thing, you know, we mentioned that the mechanism of evolution is the mechanism of time and chance mutations over millions and millions of millions of years, whereby somehow non-living matter became living. All of a sudden, somehow, you have protozoa. You have single-cell life forms, invertebrate things like an amoeba. And then over millions of years again, now you evolve to a higher level of complexity, supposedly. And now you have metazoa, invertebrates, multi-celled animals, like a jellyfish, unfortunately, like perhaps some Christians during the week.
Anyway,
that was a slam there. Okay, at any rate, we have metazoa. And then you inject the magic wand of millions and billions of years, of course, and chance mutations. And somehow the metazoa, multiple celled invertebrates evolved into vertebrate fish with bones. And it's hard to find fish without bones unless you really bury your soul. And in that case, soul is a fish, okay?
You're starting to wake me up over here, John.
Okay, all right, I'm sorry. I know you just had lunch, all right? So at any rate, so we have vertebrate fishes, and again, you inject the millions of years, and you eventually have amphibia, which would, of course, include salamanders and frogs that would, of course, eventually become handsome young princes. You inject the millions and billions of years. You eventually have reptiles. Some reptiles evolved into birds, or the latest story, some reptiles evolved into dinosaurs, and some of the dinosaurs evolved into birds. And from you also have mammals evolving, those that were afraid of heights and things like that, and flying. And some of those terrestrial mammals return to the sea from whence they came. That's where we get the whale, which I, of course, believe is definitely a whale of a tail. And we get the sea cows and things like that. And then eventually, for those that didn't go back into the sea, we come to a common ancestor from which ape and man diverge. And ape and man coming from a common ancestor. And then following the line of man, we have transitional form, supposedly. We have the links between man and the ape. Oh, no, excuse me, man and the common ancestor, okay? It's interesting. Men objected to being told that they had evolved from apes. Not everyone went ape over that idea, okay? And so, of course, the story changed to make it a little more palatable. Not only that, but somewhat easier to swallow. And that is, a man didn't evolve from an ape. He evolved from an ancestor from which also came the ape, okay? So anyway, you had the handsome young prince for the frog that wasn't kissed. So the reason I went through all of that again, I know we did that last week, because it's so important that, according to the evolution story, it's not a missing link between ape and man, or the common ancestor and man. It is literally millions upon millions upon millions,
yes,
of little transitional changes between one kind and another kind, something referred to as macroevolution. Now, you can take something like that, let's say lizards become birds, and you'll come up with something and say, well, here's something halfway between lizard and bird. It's the missing link. Well, again, it's not a single missing link, it's millions. You take the lizard. The idea was put forth that lizards evolved into birds because lizards, trying to flee from predators, not only that, but something that wanted to hurt them or eat them, they'd be running along the rocks with their little legs just a going, and pretty soon the legs would kind of flare out, and eventually, and he would say, I can fly. I can fly. Now, as I say this, this sounds absolutely insane, okay? And I don't mean this to just be entertainment, but that's exactly what was put forth. Now, since then, it's been tweaked, if you will, and tremendously technical jargon and technical terms have been brought in so that the same thing is said, but it's said in a way that you say, well, yeah, I can see that. I'm a relatively intelligent person. I can understand how that would happen.
Get that scientific lingo in there.
You get that jargon in there, and you take a young person going through high school biology class.
Impressionistic.
Yeah, very impressionistic, especially with the big words, the professor, the teacher, and please don't misunderstand, I don't mean to put down any teacher or professor. Most teachers and professors are teaching what they teach because they believe it's true. And I spent a lot of years myself as a teacher, and I can look back on things that later I found out that I'd believe were true that were not, and I pray we're still pliable and not so full of pride.
Which makes me wonder, John, why aren't we just teaching what we know to be fact? Why all the speculation are we teaching as if it were fact?
Yes, as far as the science in support of the creation viewpoint, am I tracking with you? Or
We're teaching our kids that the evolutionary story is true, and that there are the Earth is billions of years old. And that's really conjecture. It's a worldview. It's not a fact.
Oh, absolutely. And you're very well read, Dave, in this area. And as so many of our programs now, we've gone into the dating methods and how they work, and a completely different story relative to what we see, the physical Earth and the universe, very different than what are being taught in our science classes. And it's very unfortunate because the story of the creation account and the science in support of the creation account just makes so much more sense. And again, not to beat it to death, but it's just intellectually dishonest. It's very alarming to me. I'm a grandfather, that my children, if they're not educated in a private school, Christian school, or homeschooled, that they're going to get this philosophy of evolution and nothing to contrast it with, no alternate view, not even the option to share an alternate view or a glimpse of an alternate view. And that brings me right back to our opening verse for today. Any story sounds true until someone tells the other side. Well, if there is another side, it's not given. You know, where a young mind can take and assess the support or evidence relative to each of the views and make an intelligent decision, again, and there is another view, then that is indoctrination. That is brainwashing. That is not education. Education should be supplying all of the information, allowing that young mind to process that information, to come to a personal conclusion relative to that information, and then to make their choice. Well, that's the conclusion, to make their choice and stand on it. That is education. That is teaching a young person to think deductively, inductively, and come to a conclusion that would be their personal conclusion, not just a parroting of propaganda.
That's right.
So anyway, went off onto a lot there, but this is a big issue. And when I say I have a bone to pick relative to the fossil record, I most certainly do, because this other story and the misrepresentation, by the way, the fossil record, as we brought out last week, just incredible. Okay, back on this for a moment. So it's not just one transitional form from one kind to another kind. It's millions upon millions upon millions. This little lizard trying to flee from predators, these little feet of his to evolve into wings and feathers. I mean, my word, the skin of a lizard, there's folds in the skin, scales. And you compare the skin of a lizard to the intricate complexity of a feather. Yeah, a feather is designed for strength and minimum weight. It's extremely complex in its design. The lung structure of a lizard relative to the lungs of a bird, completely different, not even close. The same thing with the bones themselves. The bones, when they're designed for lightness and strength and flight. And on it goes. I just think I had a thought here back to I'm retired military. The T-38 aircraft and the F-5A and F-5B had the structure of the wing was a honeycomb structure, and it was designed for maximum lightness and strength. And it was taken, basically the design, as I recall, off of the honeycomb of the bees. And which is a tremendous geometrical shape as far as strength relative to the thickness of the walls and things like that. I'm tapping back into an area we've already talked about, the design we find all around us. So anyway, back to the lizard and the bird, phenomenal differences. So again, not a single transitional form, but millions of little bitty changes. Now, last week we touched... it's so important we understand that. I read a quote last week from Charles Darwin. I went ahead and read it again this week because chances are you didn't memorize it. And you want a shot at that, Dave?
No, I don't think
no.
So.
No, okay, all right, okay. Well, here's the quote. This is from Darwin's book on the Origin of Species, 1859, relative to the fossil record. He said this: "As by this theory, innumerable, that is countless, numberless transitional forms must have existed, from one kind to evolve into another kind." That's true. "Why do we not find them embedded in the crust of the earth? Why is all nature not in confusion instead of being, as we see them, well-defined species?" As mentioned last week, if we handle these millions of little changes between a lizard and a bird, you know, how do you classify a lizard and a bird? I mean, where do you draw that line between the two when you have these millions of little changes, he says. He says, well, you know, let's read on. Geological research does not yield the infinitely, that is countless, many fine gradations, little bitty changes, between past and present species required by the theory, his theory. And this is the most obvious of many objections which may be argued against the theory, against it. The explanation lies, however, in the extreme imperfection of the geological record. They just haven't been dug up yet. And as you brought out last week, Dave, you know, the museum in Great Britain. And what British museum? I'm trying to remember the guy's
name. Natural Museum?
Yeah, about 70,000?
They've got 7 million.
7 million.
Of artifacts there, fossils.
Yeah, and there's a letter somewhere I've seen on a video that was written to the curator of that museum and why he didn't give an example in a book that he had written of a transitional form between one kind and another kind, and the reply was he didn't have one. This is the guy that was in charge of the museum, as best as I recall.
That's right.
You know, and we touched last week briefly on some things that were some transitional forms that were put forth as absolute proof that evolution were true. I mentioned Nebraska Man, which turned out to be the tooth of an extinct pig that was used in the Scopes Monkey Trial in 1925. We mentioned Piltdown Man, an intentional hoax, an ape's jaw, and human skull fragments. They've been intentionally doctored to make them appear old and appear transitional. That was an absolute fraud and continued to be used in textbooks. Southwest Colorado Man, a single tooth of an extinct horse. The Neanderthals that have been found, the initial one that apparently had rickets or osteoarthritis and was had a stooped over appearance. Well, they've dug up many since the initial find, and where the stooped over appearance was not there because that particular Neanderthal wasn't suffering from rickets. Cro-Magnon Man, another one, which turns out to be really fully human. Heidelberg Man, found in Germany in 1907, from a single jawbone. A mandible found in Germany. The difficulty with this particular link lies in the fact that the jaw structure of natives of New Caledonia is like the Heidelberg jaw, you know, and the Caledonians are fully human. And the list goes on and on. But I want to stop here momentarily on one that's put forth as just absolute an icon, again, as far as from the common ancestor to man, and that's Lucy. And by the way, I have a picture here just to perk you up a little bit. That's kind of what she might look like. Okay. Well, I can't share that. I want to get that across to you guys that are listening this morning. Okay. But in 1974, Donald Johanson discovered the somewhat famous Lucy in Ethiopia. And she's been classified as one of the Australopithecines. There are several problems with Lucy as far as being transitional between ape, or that common ancestor, and man. She's claimed to have walked upright primarily because of her knee joint. Now, what's interesting is the knee joint was found some 1 mile from the skeleton and some 200 feet deeper in stratification. Richard Leakey, he's son of Lewis Leakey, he disagrees with his father that Lucy walked upright and has now published his own view relative to Lucy. Again, we're talking about different stories for the same physical object. He disagrees with his father, and now he's published his own, that she was long-armed, short-legged, and a knuckle walker, similar to the African apes. Now, there's even further debate that Lucy might not have been female, but male. Now, that's really doesn't sound too solid a pillar to base a case on of the evolution of man from this.
That's the best they got, huh, John?
That's the best they've got.
Wow.
Okay.
Not much.
Now, I want to hit a couple of these other things with you.
John, before we go on, how crazy do you have to be to pick up a knee joint a mile away, 200 feet farther down, and say, this is the knee joint of this creature?
Well, you can get a government grant and get paid very well for doing that, Dave, not to be too cynical here.
And, you know, speaking of cynicism, it was 2 weeks. In two more weeks, his government grant would have run out before when he found this. And lo and behold, Just in the nick of time.
Just in the nick of time.
What
absolutely.
Do you know?
Well, you know, we fun about this a little bit, but this government grant thing, you know, there are, I had a man I knew for some time that was a theistic evolutionist. He believed God used evolution as his mechanism. That's how he did it. Well, I visited with this man several times, primarily from a biblical perspective, since he was a Christian. And in this particular case, this man was very successful in his field. He taught at a school, and he taught in the church as far as theistic evolution. And for this man to ever change his mind that it would appear that evolution is not the mechanism that God used to bring about life as we have it now, it would just absolutely crumble 30-something years in his field. It would just fall apart. His reputation has a tremendous reputation among paleontologists in this particular state and the surrounding states relative to a T-Rex discovery some years back. And so the implications relative to embracing a worldview are far-reaching in a person's vocation, as we know. The documentary Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, I think really depicted that quite well, that those that would have a different view relative to evolution and how it really destroyed some careers. And the same thing is happening now, of course, I believe, in this with the topic of global warming. Those that will not embrace the politically correct view. And I just downloaded off of Fox News, SciTech, here just recently an article about global cooling. And scientists, as scientists grow in number, that are proposing that it's global cooling, not global warming. Well, that's just about as opposite as you can get. But the bottom line is what is embraced as politically correct. That's where that grant money goes. You know, that mantle of approval,
right.
That's where the funds go. Well, anyway, I wanted to touch up one that perhaps someone has said to you if you're a creationist and believe in the creation account, reproducing according to the kind, and that's the duckbill platypus is put forth as a transitional form. Well, the duckbill platypus is kind of a unique little guy, and of course this duckbill platypus lives today in Australia. It's not something millions of years ago on the fossil record. The little guy's alive today, and kind of unique, but they're put forth as transitional between mammals and birds. And the reason for that is they have fur like a mammal. They nourish their young with milk, like a mammal. Their young hatch from eggs, like reptiles. They have webbed feet, like a duck, and a flat bill, like a duck. And it has pockets in its jaws to carry food, like some squirrels. A spur on its rear legs, which, like a snake's fang, is poisonous. These are really interesting little guys, okay? But interesting, they're alive today. Platypus fossils are the same as modern forms. Platypi have been found in the fossil record, no different than the living platypus of today. Some would term a living fossil, which is, of course, oxymoronic. Not only that, but they're two terms that don't go together either. The complex structure of the egg and milk glands are always fully developed and offer no solution as to their origin and development of the womb or the milk glands and their development. And the more typical mammals are found in much lower strata than the egg-laying platypus, which it should be the other way around if it's a product of evolution. And, of course, the duckbill platypus does tell us two things. Number one, God does have a sense of humor.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, okay. And number two, God doesn't waste any leftover parts. He uses them all.
That's right. Yeah,
absolutely. You know.
Must be Scottish.
So, yes. Must be, but not transitional, no. Interesting creature, but transitional, no. The same thing with Archaeopteryx. This is supposed to be the transitional form between lizard and bird. And, of course, again, the latest school of thought is dinosaur to bird. But anyway, Archaeopteryx is found in virtually probably all books having to do with paleontology or biology, and this supposedly, again, Archaeopteryx evolved from a reptile. Well, most paleontologists now classify Archaeopteryx as a true bird. Each of the features of Archaeopteryx is either found to exist in true birds or has been absent in many reptiles. And there's a vast difference between the lungs of a reptile, again, and those of a bird. As I mentioned a little earlier, the lungs of reptiles consist of millions of tiny air sacs, whereas birds' lungs have tubes. They're not even close to being the same. Fossils of modern birds have been found in the same stratification as Archaeopteryx. Therefore, there's no way that Archaeopteryx could be a precursor, if you will, to modern bird and found the same stratification. And our time is really running down here, and that's all right. This is probably a good... I'm going to go ahead and mention this real quickly. I'm going to talk real fast now, so stay with me, okay? The horse, the three-toed to the two-toed to the one-toed horse. You know, you've seen the charts, a little bitty horse going to the big horse. You know, and first of all, to find out if these little pieces of bone that have been found were, in fact, horses, you know, you need to have them, put them in a little room, let them get to know each other, fall in love, get married, and see if their offspring could do the same thing, to be of the same kind. You know, how do we know, in fact, that they are of the same kind? And, you know, really, what does it demonstrate? Little horse and a big horse. Guinness Book of World Records has a picture by Guinness Book of World Records of Gumba, a miniature yearling stallion, an American miniature yearling stallion that stands 18 inches at the shoulders. Well, this little guy's alive, okay? And you can take a Clydesdale. It weighs as much as 3,200 pounds. It stands some 7 feet tall. You know, well, they're both still horses. You know, and a matter of fact, if you were to take the eyeball of a Clydesdale and the eyeball of little Gumba, and you were going to argue on compacting complexity, you could almost argue that Gumba was more complex than the Clydesdale because it's all in a smaller spot, you know, for the eyes to work. It doesn't really demonstrate anything. And I guess I'm going to include with this verse I mentioned last week, right out of Hebrews 11, verse 1, faith is the essence of things unseen, the substance of fossils hoped for. Okay, and the bottom line is the fossil record really argues the creation viewpoint. The bones cry out, if you will, that you can believe Genesis chapter 1.
That's right, John. It really does take just way more faith than what I have to believe in the story of evolution, that one kind could evolve into another kind with absolutely no fossil record to back that up. And it's just too incredible.
Yeah.
Well, John, last minute here. How can people write to you and ask you questions?
You can write me directly at my email address, which is jnay@creationscience.net. I really solicit your input. Please contact me, whether you agree with me on things or not. I would really like to hear from you. I'd also like to take a second to thank Prescott Valley Christian Church for their support of this program, and Palmer Christian Church in Palmer, Alaska, for their support also.
Okay, well, come on back next Sunday and every Sunday at the same time, 9 to 9:30, to hear more of Dinosaur Science in the Bible with retired Bible professor Dr. John Nay. Till next week, we'll see you then.